भगवते वासुदेवाय ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, 10th Canto, Chapter 77, Text 10 and Text 11. We'll chant responsively. Text number 10. Ratam prapaya me sutta savasyantikam ashu vai sambramas te Na kartavyo mayavi shubha rad ayam ratam prapayame sutta savasyanti kamashuvai sambramastu na kartavyo Mayavi Shobharadhayam Pratam Prapayame Sutta Savashanti Kamashuvai Sambramasthena Kartavyo Mayavi Shobharadhayam Please chant. Okay, real cool boys. Bhaktivedanta Academy boys. Bhaktivedanta Academy girls. Oh, come on, you can do much better than that. There we go. Kids should know that this is an important part of the class, Srila Prabhupada always executed that everyone should chant a verse like this, so it's a good thing to do. Word for word. Ratam, chariot, prapaya, bring, me, my, sutta, O driver, salvasya, of salva, antikam, into the proximity. Ashu, quickly. Vai, indeed. Sambrama, bewilderment. Te, by you. Na kartavya, should not be experienced. Mayavai, a great magician. Shobharat, Lord of Shobha. I am this. Translation. Lord Sri Krishna said, O driver, quickly take my chariot near Salva. This Lord of Shobha is a powerful magician. Don't let him bewilder you. Please repeat. Lord Krishna said, O driver, quickly take my chariot near Salva. This Lord of Shobha is a powerful magician. Don't let him bewilder you. Next 11, I'll just chant. Iti yuktyascha dayam, ashu ratam ashtaya daruka vishantam dadbrishu sarve svepara chananagnugam. Translation. Thus ordered, Daruka took command of the Lord's chariot and drove forth. As the chariot entered the battlefield, everyone there, both friend and foe, caught sight of the emblem of Garuda. Shaksu unmilitam yinatasmai sri gurave namaha. Mukam karoti vachalam pandunam jayate girim yakripa tamaham vande sri gurum dinitarinam. Vancha kalpaturibhyascha kripa sindhubhyevacha patitanam pavanevyo vaishnavevyo namo namaha. Jaya Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Shivasadi Gaura Bhaktivinoda. Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Srimad Bhagavatam, a very means of conquest. Actually, the instructions of Srimad Bhagavatam are there to give us the ability, to give us the strength to overcome difficulties, obstacles, and conundrums, if you will, quandaries in our path of devotional service. So it's very important that we hear Srimad Bhagavatam class, that we listen to the instructions in Srimad Bhagavatam class, that we acquaint ourselves with the subject matter of the Srimad Bhagavatam class. So in preparing for this class, I noted that I had two verses to speak on and that neither of the two verses have a purport. So I asked about this, and I was told, well, the successive verses after this are graphic details of the battle that takes place between Salva and Krishna, and not so suitable for children. Now, as a parent, or a past parent, I found that the best way to interest a child in something is to tell them, no, you can't do it, no, you can't read it, no, you can't see it. So I don't know, maybe this was a trick to interest our younger listeners here and the classic battle scenes from Srimad Bhagavatam, maybe. But I don't think it will surprise anyone to find that most of the kids here in this class are probably familiar with the Avengers, Iron Man. These are probably subjects not unknown to them. And, you know, so many other presentations in our modern society. And these particular types of presentations do not shy away from enthusiastic, to say the least, battle scenes, fighting and, you know, things of this nature. Now, these types of movie plots, they actually go to strengthen the point that everything originates from Krishna and his pastimes. The battle scenes in the Mahabharata, battle scenes in the Ramayana, battle scenes in the various chapters of the Bhagavad Purana, they rival any of these plots that we see in these so-called movie presentations. And as far as graphic content of battle, I mean, you can't beat Dhruva fighting with the Yakshas. I mean, the details given in that chapter of the activities going on in the battlefield, You know, very, very serious, serious stuff. However, there is one difference in these two types of battles. Maybe some of the kids here, Adesh, what's the difference, you know? No? Ramchandra, you know the difference? Who knows the difference? Well, the difference is that Krishna's pastimes are real. Krishna's the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and these pastimes of his are there for our upliftment. These other characters that we've mentioned, they're all make-believe. They don't really exist. Their observance of their activities does nothing to advance us spiritually, to enhance our Krishna consciousness, or to give us clarity in what is the real purpose of life. Now, there's one other thing as well. At the end of every pastime of Krishna, at the end of every set of verses glorifying Krishna and his devotees, there's what's called a Pala Stuti. Pala Stuti comes from the word meaning reward. So at the end of hearing these pastimes of Krishna, at the end of chanting various slokas, there's a reward given. Liberation, different kinds of blessings, different benedictions of purity. These are all there when one recites the pastimes of the Lord, when one glorifies the Lord's devotees, when one remembers the activities of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, as given to us by the previous acharyas. We get some benefit. I think it's pretty fair to say there's no such palastuti in hearing the pastimes of these other individuals we previously mentioned. They don't give any benedictions or blessings of liberation from material bondage or purification of consciousness or upliftment of one's process in birth and death and things like this. So, you know, this is a very important thing to keep in mind that, yes, there are some exactly detailed descriptions of these different types of battles, but they are there for our benefit, and we should enjoy, rejoice, and be enthusiastic to hear about them. So, having cleared that subject, here in these two verses today, we have the scene being set up for us, and ultimately by Vyasadeva, of Krishna's entry into the final chapter of Salva's life. This is going to be it for him. Salva doesn't know it at this point. You know, this is the interesting thing. He has no real clue that it's about to end. Of course, this is the nature of false ego. He's thinking he's going into this thing and he's going to win it for everything. You know, he's just going to come out of this completely, you know, glorious and victorious and, you know, as they say, smelling like a rose. But we know, having heard this story many, many times, and seeing who his opponent is, being the personality of Godhead, that the outcome will be much different than what he is expecting. And there's been a lot discussed on this subject over the last few weeks in various points that have led up to this. Having not had the pleasure of attending the class and not had the pleasure to speak on this subject, but if I repeat anything, I'll beg your pardon and tolerance, but taking a page from Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, who was known for sometimes studying the same verse for 1 month at a time, I think we can maybe repeat a few things with no harm. So in this first verse here, verse number 10, Salva is referred to as Sobharat. Now actually there's many names for Salva. Sobharaj, Sobharat, Sobhapatni. These all refer to one who is the Lord and Master of Shobha. This is, of course, that flying city. Shubhara, one who comes from that city. And Shubharastan, one who sits in the seat of that city. So these are all different names referring to Salva in his position in accordance with the city he's governing and flying in. And they all are names that indicate a position of strength, a position of power, a position of conquering authority. However, none of this is of any concern or intimidation to Lord Krishna. Not in the slightest. Generally, when we hear that there's someone very powerful who's in a antagonistic mood towards us or approaching us in that manner, we become a bit intimidated. We become a bit, you know, concerned. Krishna has no such concern. It's as if there's just a fly in the air and he's going to swat it away. Not even that much effort is put into Krishna's thinking when it comes to dealing with Salva. And, I mean, let's face it, Krishna is one who is feared by fear itself. We're all very fearful of something. They have this list of, you know, different kinds of phobias. Afraid of flying, or afraid of spiders, or afraid of being locked in a closet, or afraid of going to Mongol RT, different types of fears like that. So they have names for all those. And they ultimately describe fear. Well, Krishna is the one that fear is afraid of. So he's not concerned about this. Actually, it's an interesting thing for the older listeners here. There's an act of Congress called the No Fear Act. And it's put into place to protect those who are whistleblowers or who feel there's been some type of discrimination against them in the workplace and government scenarios. It's called the No Fear Act. So Krishna is the originator of the No Fear Act. He has no fear. And this is the appropriate mood for a Kshatriya. Setting aside that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, as a Kshatriya, the role he is playing, this is the appropriate mood. I have no fear in going into battle. I will challenge this opponent head on. You think you have something? I'll show you what's what. This is the way, you know, a Kshatriya has that kind of bravado, very self-confident and forceful in going into the battle, and this is important for that mood. So this is the mood that Krishna sets forth. Now, he says in that mood, he says to Daruka, take my chariot near Salva. I want to get up close and check this guy out. He doesn't say, okay, keep me over here from a distance, so I just kind of see maybe, oh, okay, he's up there. No, he wants into the fray right off the bat. Now, as he says to Daruka, take my chariot into this, he gives him a warning. Now, whenever the Supreme Personality of Godhead issues a warning, our ears should perk up. We should want to hear, because Krishna is always got the best interest of his devotees in mind. So if he gives a warning, we can generally assume that it can be spread out a little broader than just the one person it's intended for. So what does he say here? Salva is a powerful magician. Don't let him bewilder you. Now, don't let him bewilder you. This is something that we can take into our daily devotional practices. As we go about our devotional life, as we go about executing Krishna consciousness, there are various illusions that will present themselves to us. Just as Salva's got the ability to make his ship appear here or not appear there, or to be many ships, or just to be one ship, or to be on the water, or be on a mountain, or all these different things due to his abilities, Maya has the ability to appear before us in so many different forms. Now, there's no cookie-cutter method for avoiding Maya, because each one of us has different strengths and weaknesses. And Maya is completely aware and knowledgeable of what your weaknesses are, of what your strengths are, of what your weaknesses are, of what your strengths are, and they're each different from everyone else's. I mean, ultimately, they all come to the fact that we think we're this body and we're meant to enjoy it. But the subtleties of how we think that are different for each of us. So Maya gets in all these different ways. Because after all, she's very expert at her service. And her service is to keep all the nonsenses out of the spiritual world. So that's us, or it's me. So Krishna gives her the potency to have expertise in executing her service. So whatever difficulty is needed for our particular scenario, she presents that. But Krishna's instructing us here, don't be bewildered. Do not be bewildered by this. Now, how do we do that? How do we prevent ourselves from being bewildered when day in and day out, we're going to be faced with these? It's not like Maya gives us one shot. Okay, I test. Oh, okay. You pass the exam. Okay, good. I won't bother anymore. Wouldn't it be great if classes were like that? When the Jai Shri Radhe gave you boys a you know, test one day, okay, that's it, no more tests the rest of the year, you pass. Yeah? Who'd like that? Which of you students would like one test for the entire year and not another test the rest of the year? Okay, which of you think that's really going to happen? Yeah, which of you teachers are going to give one test only a year? Yeah, you see, no hands went up, kids. So you got to be prepared day in and day out. You have to constantly be ready for the tests that are coming. Just as devotees, we have to constantly be ready for the continuing tests, for the continuing challenges that Maya presents to us. How do we do that? Very simple. Anyone have an answer? Any of the children know how we do that? Yes, Sarva. You have to speak louder. It's all the... Yes, that's exactly right. The short version of what you said is to take shelter of Krishna. And to take shelter of Krishna by his holy names. Thank you very much for that answer. This is our shelter, to take shelter of the holy names. Because the holy name is non-different than the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And when we are in the company of the holy name, when the holy name is on our lips, when we are calling out the holy name in appreciation, in gratitude, out of fear, out of distress, or out of need, then this is the proven system given to us by our acharyas time and time again by which Krishna will reward his devotees. Which of the kids would like to get a reward from Krishna? Which of the adults would? So that reward is the holy name. But wait a minute. You just said, I chant the holy name, and the reward is chanting the holy name? It's both the means and the goal. The more we chant, the more we want to chant. And the more we want to chant, the more we want to chant. So this is the nature of the holy name, is that it's completely the be-all and end-all. Now, one thing I noticed here, in the story of this amazing city of Salva, it's constructed by Maya Dhanava. And of course, I mean, we would expect nothing less from Maya Dhanava. He is the top of the architects. I mean, we have devotees who go to school for architecture, and I know three or four devotees that studied this and that worked really hard at it. And, you know, they probably will, in due course, build some really nice things. But Maya Dhanava, he builds amazing things. I mean, just incredible stuff for everybody. All the big demigods and everybody go to him. They want something built? Hire Maya Dhanava. He's the guy. You know, it doesn't even have to put out a publicity ad or a business card. Just, bump, Maya Dhanava's not. I got to think, I wonder if Maya Dhanava ever has a bad day. Yeah, I know that's supposed to look like solid floor, but it's really just water. Oh, yeah, I know the plane didn't go off again. No, you never read about that. Maya Dhanava never fails. So he's created this vimana. Now, you know, I did some research. You came up with some intriguing information to my thinking of vimanas. And there's a number of places where these vimanas are described. And most of the places that talk about vimanas that are not discussed by devotees reference or quote from the devotees, prominently Sataputta, on their research and discussion on these things. It's kind of interesting. It seems that most of your vimanas had a triangular shape to them. And many of them had this triangular shape, but multiple peaks or tops around them, like a big triangle and then smaller ones as well. And this triangular shape seemed to assist in the so-called cloaking device or invisibility that they could sometimes invoke and manifest. It seems that most of them had four wheels of sorts that appeared to be like firebrands whirling in the sky. It brought a type of illumination to them and a method of transporting around. It's interesting, there's a section in the Old Testament, in the book of Ezekiel, where Ezekiel talks about having seen these firebrands of whirling fire in the sky. And it's understood that, you know, this seems to indicate that he saw vimanas at that time. The interesting thing, they can move around like a plane or an helicopter. They could go this way, they could come straight up, straight down. You know, they seem to defy the laws of propulsion and the laws of gravity. And, you know, we can understand that such traits in these manas is not so difficult, because they were created of both gross and subtle material and spiritual energies. They combined all of these different elements and aspects so that they, as a result, were able to transgress the laws of normal travel that we seem to know about. Excuse me. Here from the Krishna book. Salva's airplane is described as such. The airplane occupied by Salva was very mysterious. It was so extraordinary that sometimes many planes would appear to be there in the sky. And sometimes there were apparently no planes in the sky. Sometimes the plane was visible, and sometimes it was not visible. The warriors of the Yadu dynasty were puzzled about the whereabouts of the particular airplane. Sometimes they could see it on the ground, sometimes flying in the sky, sometimes on the peak of a hill, sometimes floating in the water. The wonderful airplane flew in the sky like a whirling firebrand and was not steady for even a moment. This interesting description here in the it can be found as far back as the Rig and Yajur Vedas, describing these different types of airplanes and machines. From the Yajur Veda, a royal skilled engineer can construct sea boats propelled on water by experts, and airplanes that move forward and fly upward after the clouds that reside in the mid-region of the skies, and that fly as boats might move on the sea, and that fly high over and below various types of clouds. Thereby, they are prosperous in this world and created for both flying and lightning effects. From the Rig Veda, it's an interesting description of six different types of airplanes. The Jalayan, which is a vehicle that's designated to operate in the air or the water. The Jara, the Kara, which is a vehicle that operates on the ground and in the water. The Tritala, which is a vehicle that consists of three different stories. The Trichakrarat, which is a three-wheeled vehicle that operates only in the air. The Vayurat, which is a vehicle that is gas or wind-powered. And the Vidyutrat, which is a vehicle that operates on its own type of power. It's described that they're highly talented woodworkers called Rajadaras, who were skilled in mechanical contrivances that could be made to operate across oceans just like chariots. And these same persons also manufactured flying chariots to carry as many as 1,000 passengers at once. These chariots were as fast as thought itself. This is from the Rig Veda. So this idea of airplanes is not anything new, and, you know, actually dates back very long into human history. But okay. Let's move away from airplanes for a while, because all I want to do is hop in one and go to Vrindavan when I talk about airplanes. When a city is attacked, and this is what's going on here, York is being attacked. When a city is attacked in battle, the leaders always make great preparation. And this purpose is to protect not only the city itself, but the citizens. So when Salva began to attack, the leaders of the city made the following preparations. This is from the Mahabharata. Of course, the city gates were all closed and secured. Flags in the city were flown that noted a state of emergency. Soldiers were deployed to the different strategic positions. Bridges were pulled down. Now, I don't know if that means they were torn down or if they were just pulled into some collapsed form so they couldn't be used. All boat traffic was suspended. Waterways were made dangerous by putting spikes in them. Trenches were dug and the ground was plowed up to make it difficult for troops to traverse across the ground. Roads were spiked. Ample stocks of food and provisions were made. Landmines were laid. Cannons were placed in the turrets. Catapults were readied with firebrands, night soil, and bundles of dry grass waiting to be lit. The senior members of the family, such as Ugrasena and Uddhava, instructed all persons to give up drinking so that everyone would remain sober and alert. Keep this in mind. If you think that maybe some point you're not going to be very sober or alert. So entertainers, dancers, and songsters were sent away. This is no time for fun. We're going to be serious here. So this is the preparations that Ma Bart mentions were made before Salva attacked. So it also mentions another thing that we covered it in the beginning of this chapter with Prajumna. Once he was attacked and fell unconscious and was taken off the battlefield and then brought back onto the battlefield. And when he came back onto the battlefield, he was fired up. To his mind, he had been taken off the battlefield in shame. Now he had to right that. He came back ready to go for it. And he started attacking with ferocity. It mentions actually that he was attacking Salva so much that the next arrow he pulled was going to be Salva's death. Narada and Vayu were dispatched by the divine entities to go and stop them. They appeared before Prajumna and said, "You're not the one that's meant to kill Salva. That is saved for Krishna, son of David. So put your arrow back in." Do you know how hard that would be? It's almost like, finally, Salva, so I'm going to get him now. You got the arrow pulled and... All right. What he did? After all, this was Krishna's service, not his. So let's move on to verse number 11. Now here, this description in verse number 11. Thus ordered, Daruka took command of the Lord's chariot and drove forth. As the chariot entered the battlefield, everyone there, both friend and foe, caught sight of the emblem of Garuda. This is the crowning moment of the battle. The crowning moment. Krishna's chariot's coming on and everyone can see. Even if you can't see Krishna face to face, you can see over the heads of all the warriors in the battle. There, look, the flag. Garuda's emblem on the flag. Krishna's come to the battlefield. This just gave such satisfaction and pleasure to everyone on the battlefield. This is like the big moment, The savior of all, Krishna, has now entered into the battlefield. Such a great joy and exultation must have arisen, Everyone's so happy. Now, the Sanskrit word used in this verse for Garuda, Aruna Anujam. This means the younger brother of Aruna. How many of you knew Garuda had a brother? Yeah. You know everything, Garanga. Everybody knows that. Garuda had a brother. His name was Arun. So I thought we might, since he's referred to as Arun's brother, I thought we might take a moment and look a little bit at Arun, who he was. We have no reason to mention it if it wasn't brought up in the class. So there was a lady by the name of Vinata, and she was one of the wives of Kasyapa Muni. And from Kasyapa Muni, as you remember in the Bhagavatam, they were creating progeny for the universe. She gave birth to two sons, Arun and Garuda, and they came as eggs. So she had to make a promise when these eggs were delivered that she would not disturb them and let them come to maturity on their own. 1,000 years. Of course, this is demigod time, so that's not so long as we might think of 1,000 years. So she got a little impatient, and she just couldn't wait, so she broke open the one egg after 500 years. And the child came out very angry and very reddish in color and was very upset with his mother. Why have you, before the time you've broken, I'm not even fully manifested. The bottom half of him was just like this red effulgence. So the benediction had been that when he would be born, he would be as bright as the noonday sun. But because he had been prematurely brought out of the egg, he didn't get the fulfillment. So it's actually he comes before the noonday sun, which is the morning dusk. When the dusk comes up, the sun has that red effulgence. This is the explanation why. So he implored his mother, okay, at least wait the full time for my brother. So this was Garuda. So she waited another 500 years, and then Garuda was born. So in this way, they both had their particular services. Now, it's a very detailed story, so I won't get into it, but there was a scenario where Vinata and Garuda were both cursed and had to become servants of the co-wife and her sons, who were all the snakes, and this whole big thing happened. But it leads up to the point that there was a time when the serpents were about to get the Amrita, the immortal nectar. And it had been clearly stated that these serpents, they had a nature about them, which we all know of snakes, very poisonous and problemsome. So it was not a good idea for them to get the nectar of immortality. So Garuda was engaged by Indra to secure that nectar. No, I'm sorry. Indra was protecting it, but Garuda, because he was serving the mother and her sons, the snakes, was employed by them to get it. But he didn't really want to do it, so he kind of got in cahoots with Indra behind the scenes. And it was arranged that Agni would assist him. And so in this way, Garuda approached this. The pot of immortality was protected first by a spinning wheel that had very small spoke spaces and were sharp like razors, and by two serpents. So Garuda shrank himself down to a very small size, slipped in between the wheels, created a dust storm when he was in there, blinded the two serpents, and stole the pot of nectar, delivered it to the serpents. When he delivered, he said, okay, now, by delivering this to you, my mother and I are free from having to be enslaved and serve you all. He said, yep, that's all, and you just had to do that. So he mentioned, and he said, oh, by the way, you know, you're about to take the nectar of immortality. This is a really powerful thing. Maybe you should go take a bath first. I mean, this would be appropriate. So the snake said, yes, okay. So they went to take bath, and then at that point, Indra came in and snuck. He stole the Amrita and kept it. So in this way, he fulfilled his obligation to his half-brothers and was freed from having to be entangled in their service, but at the same time, kept them from getting this Amrita. So because of this, he became very effulgent. So Agni was asked, who is this second fire that's manifested here? And Agni said, no, this is just Garuda. But they said, he's so bright. So Agni asked Garuda, please tone down your effulgence. So he cut it down to half, and therefore he could be seen. So in this way, Vishnu became very, very satisfied with Garuda for saving the nectar of immortality from being improperly used, and gave him a benediction. So what benediction would you like? Garuda said, I would like the benediction to always fly above your head. And thus, he became the emblem on the flag of Krishna's chariot. So that's why Garuda is on his chariot. So, let's see what else we have here. Just drawing a little long here. At any rate, when the nectar of immortality was set down, it was set on top of some grass, and that was kusa grass, and little drops of it spilled on it. That's why kusa grass is considered so spiritual and used in all types of different religious activities. And the final benediction that Garuda was given was that he would be able to have snakes as his food. So he got back at his brothers. So at any rate, these are just some thoughts that came to mind from these two verses as we approach a so-called graphic battle. We can anticipate great descriptions of fighting and spear hurling and discus throwing and sword fighting amongst the different armies, and relish these activities as they are the pastimes of Krishna. Well, I guess I'll finish there. If anybody has any comments or questions or corrections, we'll try and dispatch with those a little later. Okay. That works for me. Thank you very much. Mudbhagavatam ki jai.